The delicate task of reimposing coronavirus restrictions will be live in Zurich with our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé on new measures being brought in by Switzerland's Federal Council. Also ahead, Beijing warns it will retaliate against the UK as Britain offers a path to citizenship for up to 3 million Hong Kongers in response to the implementation of a controversial new security law in Hong Kong. And the tempo of the US presidential race is ticking upwards. We'll round up the week's key election stories for you before the end of the programme. All that's to come here on the Late Edition on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to you to the Late Edition here on Monocle 24 on this Thursday, the 2nd of July. I'm Thomas Lewis here in Toronto. And joining me today to cast their eyes across another busy news day in many parts of the world are Monocle's Europe editor-at-large, Ed Stocker, who joins us from Verona, and from London, Monocle 24's Augustin Macellari. Well, before we hear from Ed and Augustin, let's cross live to Zurich now, where yesterday Switzerland's Federal Council announced the implementation of several new measures aimed at curbing a rise in the number of new coronavirus infections there in June. Well, to tell us more is Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. Tyler, thank you very much for being with us on the programme today. I realise it's evening with you, so very good evening to you. I wonder if you could begin just by rounding up for us what has been announced in Switzerland and why the government there felt that these new measures were required at this moment there.
Well, there's a couple of things which happened, and the Federal Council are quite good at sort of springing these press conferences on the entire country. And there is that moment where everyone sort of braces themselves. What are they going to say? As we've been discussing over the past few months, Thomas, Switzerland has been very good at presenting themselves. There is a real confident tone. The messaging has been super clear. I've even deployed our very own Nolan Giles to actually work on a story that we're looking at for September about the style of messaging. So anyway, we had this announcement that came out yesterday afternoon that the Federal Council was going to address the country. As they did, we had the president, Simonetta Sommaruga. We also had the Minister for Health, or certainly one of the council members who has health under his portfolio, Alain Berset. And it was interesting because one of the things the country has been trying to do is to coax people to wear masks. They've not wanted to follow the path of Austria or Germany, where, of course, you have an imposition of masks within a number of different settings, primarily public transport. Switzerland has really been trying to follow something of a Swiss tradition of allowing people to be responsible, to take personal responsibility, to act in the best interest of the nation, but without maybe going for the slightly more nannying tactics that we've seen elsewhere. And just recently, the country moved from being in a state of emergency, Thomas, to now more of a special situation. And so that also meant a little bit of a stepping back from the Federal Council and really more power in the hands of the cantons. Now, what happened when of course, the Federal Council stepped back is, of course, you had, of course, various cantons then suddenly saying, actually, we want to see masks imposed on trams, on trains, etc. Now, of course, this is a nation which is very proud of its rail network, and suddenly you had, I wouldn't say the country was divided, down the line, but a patchwork had evolved, and with some cantons saying, yes, you have to wear a mask if you're on a tram, bus, or on a, certainly on rail crossing the country. So what happens when you cross the canton line? Would you have to then pull a mask out of your bag, throw it on, but then when you get off the train potentially in Geneva, then of course you wouldn't need it anymore. So the Federal Council stepped in and they said, no, we are going to impose from this coming Monday, from the 6th of July, there will be a masks will be mandatory on all public transport. This came as a bit of a surprise because, again, as we've been saying, it's been very interesting, particularly in German Switzerland, Thomas, where there's almost zero uptake. If you're down in Ticino, the Italian part of the country, they were saying it's around 8 or 9%. That's even drifted back from those numbers. It's a little bit lower in French-speaking Switzerland, but really German Switzerland has not gone for it. Today now, everyone is sort of looking at it, you know, why has this happened? How do people feel about it? How is it going to be enforced? Many questions around it. So that was one thing that we saw. The second announcement was, though, that we have seen a rise in cases. Switzerland was down in single-digit territory. We were sort of 7-8 cases a day. We've now seen a spike in numbers. We're in anywhere from the mid-60s to 100 a day. So, you know, not dramatic, but at the same time, it's an uptick no matter how you look at it. And a lot of focus has been on, of course, the opening up of borders. And what we saw yesterday as well is the Federal Council saying that we are going to be imposing quarantines on certain countries. Now, those countries have not been named yet. Serbia has been a bit of a problem because we've seen a lot of people returning from Serbia, and all eyes have been on Belgrade lately, thinking that people have been visiting family, coming back to Switzerland. And so part of that has been a rise in cases that they've been able to trace back. So we will see from Monday, or probably actually I would imagine the announcement will come tomorrow, who is going to be on this list of new nations which are going to have to go into quarantine for 10 days when they come into Switzerland.
And to dig into this idea, Tyler, as you mentioned there, of many Swiss residents being caught by surprise by this announcement, we've spoken several times on the programme over the past few weeks about this idea of reimposing restrictions or bringing in restrictions for the first time. How difficult a sell has that been in Switzerland, given that you say that the number of cases is rising and is spiking? Are people kind of more acquiescent, therefore, to the idea that, you know, more localized lockdowns or more unified measures, if you like, need to be put in place? Or is the genie of the easing of lockdown, if you like, is that well and truly out of the bottle? How tricky a sell has it been there?
I don't think it's been too difficult, because on one side, I think most Swiss, Thomas, would agree they've had a very easy lockdown. They've had, you could call it a responsible lockdown on one side, and that's a lockdown of self-responsibility, or some would even say it has been a luxurious lockdown, because again, people, they did a good job. You really saw the leadership at a city level, at a canton level, at a federal level, praising people and really coaxing them along through this, and really having this balance of again, you could gather, you could go outside, you could gather in groups of five. You know, throughout, the government messaging in many parts was deliberately vague. What counted for really being public versus what was private, how many people could gather, these things were also sort of these deliberate gray areas, and it was really down to people to interpret the rules how they wanted. So I think that there's been an enormous level of public trust. I think also probably the messaging over the last 2 weeks has been, well, of course, measures have eased. You could have gatherings of up to 1,000 people now with certain measures in place. You've seen physical distancing also collapse in the country. And the government's been coming out and saying, of course, you know, more people are together, and there are, of course, numbers are going up. But as long as we have contact tracing in place, as long as we don't see them go off the charts, and I think they've brought the public along. So even though we've seen these numbers going up, and it might sound like the genie is out of the bottle, it's not a situation where it's out of control. The main thing that's also happened today, though, as well, and again, some of the problems go back to certain clubs, people gathering in basements, cramped together, and there have been some incidents now, of course, people giving the wrong phone numbers, the wrong email address, etc., and there's been sort of a bit of a public telling off, where the government is not cracked down. They've just said, come on, everybody. People do want to go out. We do want to encourage the nighttime economy if we can, but we have to play along, or you have to play along. Everyone is in this together. We would like you to go out and enjoy yourself, but please provide the appropriate details. If someone, of course, we do find has the virus, then we can advise you. So I'm quite impressed by the level of dialogue and just that it's a very mature conversation.
And just finally, Tyler, the idea of the patchwork, this patchwork of some parts of a country or some parts of a region being more locked down than other parts. Here in Canada, for example, the reopenings have been managed very much on a province by province basis. Toronto, for example, the city I'm sitting in right now, was much later in easing its restrictions than, say, Vancouver, for example, or even Calgary. Is this going to be the sort of new reality, do you think, that we're going to see here? Or will we get to a stage, Tyler, where a sort of more blanket, a return to sort of the government giving one message, one set of instructions out to the whole country. Is that going to be a looming reality for us for some time, do you think?
I think it depends on geography. And of course, you know, you're speaking from a country where you could fit many, many Switzerlands just into Ontario alone. So I think that, you know, geography does play a part in this, Thomas. And so, yes, in Canada, where you have, of course, the luxury of distance and the physical geography is so vast that, of course, you have a situation where provinces can act like they're almost sovereign nations in a way. Of course, in Switzerland, where you have many cantons and cantons which behave very differently and of course are of many political stripes, but you know, you can of course pass through a canton in 10 minutes in a train. So I think this is why they had to have a situation where Bern had to intervene at a federal level. But of course this goes against also the spirit of Switzerland. It goes against the spirit of many countries within a federalist apparatus, where they do expect that the regions should have autonomy. They should be able to go and make their own measures. And it's interesting because actually what Bern said, look at, okay, because we're dealing with national transport at many levels, you know, we have to go and let's say impose this mask measure. But Bern said, we do not want to be involved as a federal government telling people what they should be doing in nightclubs. Been very clear about that, saying we'll leave that to the cantons.
Well, Tyler, we will be speaking to you as the situation develops in Switzerland over the coming weeks. But for now, Tyler Brulé, Monocle's editor-in-chief, thank you very much for joining us here on today's edition of The Late Edition. Thank you very much, Tyler.
Thanks, Thomas.
Well, next here on The Late Edition, Beijing has warned the UK that it will retaliate following a move by the British government to grant citizenship to those seeking to leave Hong Kong. The move by Boris Johnson's government came as a controversial new security law imposed by Beijing came into force in Hong Kong. Well, the UK government isn't the only country seeking to challenge Beijing's authority in Hong Kong. In Australia yesterday, Prime Minister Scott Morrison warned Australians that the security situation in the Indo-Pacific region was about to become more fraught and potentially more dangerous. Karen Middleton is the chief political correspondent for the Saturday paper in Canberra, and she gave us her reaction to the speech on today's edition of The Globalist.
Analysts are saying it is a bit broader than China. They aren't the only aggressor in our region or in the world, but certainly it's the hostility of China that has prompted a rethink of Australia's strategic direction, and particularly in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, which has exposed holes in supply chains, including military supply chains, and also has exposed perhaps some aggressive tactics from some other countries taking advantage of the disruption. So Australia is now looking much more to its own region. While it will still participate in international adventures, as some people call them, with other countries in other parts of the world, its focus will now be much more specifically on the Indo-Pacific region.
Karen Middleton, the Saturday paper's chief political correspondent there, speaking to us a little earlier today. Augustin Macellari, who's joining us from London. To begin with you on this and to return to the moves by the British government, can you just recap for us what's being offered to Hong Kongers here by the government of Boris Johnson?
So the British government has said that China is in breach of the Sino-British Joint Declaration made back in the 80s, and that consequently it's going to revise immigration rules for British nationals overseas. So at the moment, people with that British national overseas passport are entitled to 6 months in the UK. The new proposal offers 5 years leave to remain, with the right to apply for settled status and a year after that for full citizenship. So that's quite a large set of commitments being made to almost 3 million people. There are 350,000 who hold the passport already, and 2.6 million on top of that who are eligible. It's been described in Hong Kong as a good lifeboat. Obviously, I think the majority of Hong Kongers would probably rather not have to leave their home territory if they don't have to. But it is an interesting set of proposals from a conservative government that has risked alienating its electorate in recent months. Some of the fiscal responses we've seen to COVID-19 haven't been particularly in line with traditional conservative economic policy. And it's going to be one to monitor to see if Boris Johnson can follow through on this. whether that's too much for his base to stomach, the prospect of 3 million people potentially coming into the country over the next few years.
And Ed Stocker in Verona, it's interesting that Beijing has criticised Boris Johnson's government for saying that this new offer, if you like, of potentially a path to citizenship for many Hong Kongers is a breach of the agreement that China and the UK had when the UK handed Hong Kong back to Chinese control. That is exactly what the UK government has said of Beijing's new security law in Hong Kong. Do we know at this stage exactly what the idea of retaliation that's being mooted by Beijing here will look like, what exactly they can do in return if this pledge by the British government goes through?
Exactly, Thomas. It's interesting what you were saying. Obviously, there has been a real war of words over the last few weeks. And we've seen this from China, increasingly so over the last couple of years, that it doesn't mince its words internationally when it comes to these sorts of disputes or others. And we've seen that it's been accusing the UK government and others of gross interference. I mean, it has said that it would take, and these are the words that have been used, corresponding measures. Now, at the moment, we don't know exactly what that would involve. Obviously, China is a huge trading partner, not just for the UK, but we also mentioned Australia earlier in the program. China is Australia's largest trading partner. So in that sense, in the trade sense, China does hold a few cards close to its chest that could affect these countries. It could retaliate in a trade sense. It could also restrict Chinese nationals or Hong Kong nationals from being able to travel to the UK. Again, we don't know exactly how that would be, but we don't know if those 3 million people who would be able to travel will be able to do so if China decides to step in and restrict those people from being able to travel. Dominic Raab in the UK, the foreign minister, said as such. He says, you know, there's nothing they can do, the UK government, if China does decide to step in. For now, though, it really is a bit of a war of words, and we'll have to see how this plays out, not just in the next few days, but the next few weeks, Thomas.
Well, we will, of course, be monitoring how indeed it does and all play out over the weeks to come here on Monocle 24. But finally, here on the Late Edition, let's head to the United States, where the presidential race, which has been overshadowed by the coronavirus pandemic, is rising up the news agenda in the US once again as Election Day in November nears. Ed Stocker in Verona, before moving to Europe for us, you were our editor in the United States for many years. So let's begin with you. A story that struck me this week from the presidential race in the US is the fundraising battle that's shaping up. Donald Trump, who is outraising Joe Biden by a significant margin at the beginning of the year, is now, if you'll forgive the pun, being given a run for his money by Biden. What do you make of this fundraising battle that's shaping up? How significant do you think that will be?
I know, a slight change, isn't it, Tom? Northern Italy from New York, slightly different surroundings. I mean, this is big. This is a big deal because, you know, we've talked on Monocle 24 in the magazine about the power of incumbency, the fact that, you know, you have a lot in your advantage if you happen to be the incumbent, which, of course, Donald Trump is ahead of November. And we saw before the sheer financial clout he's had. But as you mentioned, Biden has overtaken him. It's the second month in a row that Biden has raised more money. And interestingly, although it's not quite so small, some of those donations were raised by Bernie Sanders earlier in the race, the average donation is just $34 for the Biden campaign, whereas Trump is relying on several very large donors. Biden has now raised $282 million compared to $266 million from Trump. Obviously, this has to do with the fact that he's seen by some as a more favorable candidate. If we look at an average of polling, Biden is ahead. You know, look at the New York Times Siena College polling that shows Biden ahead in several key swing states such as Michigan, Wisconsin, Florida, Arizona, North Carolina, and perhaps most tellingly in Pennsylvania by 10 points, which is massive. Donald Trump won that state, you may remember, by just 44,000 votes back in 2016. An average compiled by 35.8, which is a website that compiles these sorts of things, shows that he has an average lead coming in at 9.3 points. Now, having said all of this, having talked about the importance of money, which is extremely important in US politics, and the numbers are astronomical compared to many countries in the rest of the world. So talking about money and the polls, a note of caution as well, because we are still 4 months away from voting day, and a lot can change in that time.
I was speaking, Ed, to a correspondent on one of the big TV networks in the US last week, who was talking about the big national polls that are giving Biden such a huge lead at this stage, at least. And they warned that actually it was the local polls that were probably going to be the most instructive things to look at. And I thought it was kind of interesting when the New York Times published its big landmark poll that you referenced there, that they were in fact incorporating a lot more local data, if you like, into the polls than they would usually in a national poll. Presumably that's a response to what took place in 2016 when Hillary Clinton was so far ahead in the national polls for pretty much the whole race until the final 10 days or so that changed. Augustine, just a final thought to you to bring you in on this. Joe Biden has also announced this week that he won't be holding any in-person rallies for his campaign in the foreseeable future. It's unclear what Donald Trump's next move on rallies will be. He obviously likes them a lot. They're very, usually at least, very powerful and potent for him. But given the lower turnout than expected at his recent rally in Oklahoma, running a largely online campaign, while it's highly unusual, of course, it does appear that it's served Joe Biden pretty well so far, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think those big rallies that Trump holds are for more than just his campaign. I think they're quite nice for his ego as well, Thomas. But maybe it took a bit of a denting in Oklahoma. I think that to pick up on what Ed was saying, you know, we see this lead in across swing states that Biden is holding. In a poll conducted by CNBC, the biggest a sort of locus of blame, if you like, for COVID-19 and hospitalization rates was placed by respondents on Donald Trump. 35% of respondents blamed Donald Trump for the rate of hospitalizations in the US. So from that perspective, I think this migration into digital space, if I can call it that, it's a bit like the art galleries have been doing as well, isn't it, on the part of Joe Biden, is a canny move. You know, it reflects how seriously he's taking the pandemic as an issue, not just a health issue, but also as an economic issue. Trump doesn't even wear masks when he goes out in public. So I think it's probably a policy that's going to, assuming that this issue is the kind of, is the issue that on which the election hangs, although as Ed also pointed out, that there's plenty of other problems knocking around as well. But assuming this is the one that's going to make or break Trump, I think Biden's right to stick to his guns and keep social distancing regulations firmly in place and stay online.
Well, there are 4 months to go, as Ed mentioned there, until Election Day, and we will be following the twists and turns of the presidential race here on Monocle 24 in the months to come. But that, I'm afraid to say, is all we have time for the late edition today. A big thank you to Ed Stocker in Verona and to Augusta Macellari in London and to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, in Zurich. Our production team today were Louis Allen and Sam Impey in London. A big thanks to them, as always. The late edition returns at the same time tomorrow, but for more news, more debate and much more too, do stay with us here at Monocle 24. I'm Thomas Lewis here in Toronto. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.